Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump administration's announcement that 200,000 Salvadorans living in the U.S. for 17 years or more have to get out of the country by September of 2019 or face deportation. This after earlier deportation notices to 45,000 Haitians, 2,500 Nicaraguans, and the expected forthcoming elimination of TPS, temporary protection status, for 57,000 Hondurans. Martha Arevalo, the executive director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN, who specializes in immigrant advocacy work, joins us to discuss what she sees as a cruel and arbitrary policy designed to satisfy President Trump's anti-immigrant base. About 1 million now face deportation since Trump has already rescinded DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, exposing 700,000 kids to deportation. And now he is forcing out 200,000 Salvadorans with roots in this country and about another 200,000 of their U.S.-born children who are American citizens, giving them the choice of either staying here without their parents or going back to a gang-infested country with one of the worst homicide rates in the world. Then we'll examine further Trump's anti-immigrant purge and go to Honduras to speak with Elizabeth Kennedy, a scholar who focuses on the experiences and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She has worked as a Fulbright Fellow with returned youth migrants in El Salvador who have fled gang violence, and Elizabeth is now in Honduras studying children and families fleeing rampant violence from corrupt police, military, and drug traffickers in that country. We'll look into the extent to which this is a legacy of U.S. foreign policy and what can be done to make these countries more livable for their citizens so that they don't have to flee and risk their lives trying to get to safety in the United States. Then finally, a judge today in Nevada angrily dismissed the charges against the Bundy family, who in 2014, along with about 400 so-called patriots, led an armed standoff to stop a Bureau of Land Management roundup of Bundy cattle grazing on federal lands after Cliven Bundy had refused to pay the government grazing fees for 20 years. Eric Herzig, a professor of political science and chair of the political science department at the University of Nevada, joins us to discuss how badly the federal prosecutors blew the case and the double standard that white ranchers can point assault rifles at federal officials and get away with it, but if a black urban youth tried that, he'd be shot dead. And joining us now is Martha Arevalo, who is the executive director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN, since 2012. She specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications, and has extensive experience in the areas of social marketing, public education, immigration education, civic participation, public policy, and community organizing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martha Arevalo.
Thank you.
And President Trump just announced that he's rescinding the temporary protective status for about 200,000 El Salvadorans who have been allowed to live and work legally in the United States since earthquake struck El Salvador back in 2001. So these are people with roots here in the country. I imagine they also have children. What's your sense of what this is going to do at the human level? Because many critics of the president suggest that he's always pandering to his base. So it seems to me to be a high price to pay for people and their families just to satisfy President Trump's diminishing base.
Yes, this is a very devastating day for the Salvadoran community and for its allies. It's sad news to hear that TPS has been terminated for more than 200,000 Salvadorans who have been living here for almost two decades with a work permit and who have provided for their families, who are active participants in their community, who pay their taxes and contribute greatly to this economy. It's a sad day, but we are sending a message for TPS families that they're not alone, that we will fight this, that we will fight to push for legislation to make sure that they have the opportunity to adjust to permanent legal residency.
But this is not the first group of immigrants in this country to lose their temporary protected status. Just weeks ago, more than 45,000 Haitians lost protection. that was granted after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. And apparently in the pipeline, the same's going to happen to Hondurans and Nicaraguans. So this seems to be systemic. It's not. This is not a one-off decision on the part of Trump.
Absolutely. What it's clear is that the Trump administration is sending a message that it's, doing away and ending the TPS program that has been so successful in protecting families and giving this protection. Just this year, you know, this administration and also with the Obama administration ended TPS protection for a number of countries. And so we stand in solidarity with the Haitian community, with the Honduran community, with the Somalian community, with the Nicaraguan community, who have also lost TPS or are awaiting a TPS decision. It is unfortunate. These are people that are contributing members of their communities, of society, of the economy. This is not a decision that is based on what is best for this country. This is a community that contributes greatly to this economy and to many industries in the construction and service industries. This is a decision that is based on anti-immigrant, racist Trump agenda.
Well, the TPS program itself, from what I understand, was started back in 1990 by President George H.W. Bush. Is that your understanding?
That's correct. This was part of the Immigration Act of 1990, and it was created under President Bush. And TPS for Salvadorans has been extended under both Republican and Democratic administrations. So this is, a complete reversal of, those decisions. And it's the Trump's administration continuing this agenda of, anti-immigrant sentiment, intolerance, and white supremacy.
So the argument that they're putting forth from the White House is that conditions have improved in El Salvador. Is that your understanding, one, that that's their position, and two, that conditions have improved in El Salvador?
Well, as you know, the decision was made after a couple of earthquakes, devastating earthquakes in El Salvador in 2001. And the argument is that schools have been rebuilt and hospitals have been rebuilt that were destroyed as a result of the earthquake. However, U.S. intervention has continued all of those decades in El Salvador. The war on drugs has continued for the whole Central American, Latin American region that has created a very fragile, dangerous situation in the region, where homicides are higher now in El Salvador than during the Civil War. So this is a country where maybe buildings that fell during the earthquake have been rebuilt, but a country that still is suffering a tremendous amount of instability and danger, where the United States policies, foreign policies, are directly related to what is happening to this region.
And again, I'm speaking with Martha Arevalo, who is the Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN, since 2012. She specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications. So my understanding is that about 17% of El Salvador's economy depends upon remittances from El Salvadorans living and working here in the United States. And it's a vital lifeline for the country. 4 out of 10 households in El Salvador subsist below the poverty line. And as I mentioned, something like close to $5 billion is remitted every year to El Salvadorans in the country from their relatives here in the United States. So if you kick out the people here in the United States, all that money's going to dry up, isn't it? I mean, you're going to have more people below the poverty line in El Salvador.
Absolutely. The impact is not only going to be felt in the U.S. economy, in those particular industries that I mentioned, but also in the Salvadoran economy that is greatly dependent on remittances from Salvadorans living abroad. This is a situation that is not good for the United States also, because the United States is investing millions and billions of dollars to strengthen the border, the southern border, and also The border, you know, has grown throughout Mexico to deter Central American migrants from coming north. When you destabilize an economy to such a great extent that this effect could have because of this decision, then it's going to further impact the economy, is going to, like you said, push more people into poverty, and the desperation will grow for people to migrate north looking for new opportunities. And so if you're really truly looking for ways to secure the border, if you're truly looking for ways to send a message that you want to deter migration to the United States from Central American countries, this is not the way. Every expert has told this to the Trump administration, that this is not the way. This is going to destabilize the economy and the country even more in an already fragile situation. So this has great impact to the economy in El Salvador, but also to migration of Central Americans to the United States.
But the Trump administration are arguing that temporary in the TPS, temporary means temporary, and that these El Salvadorans have been here for over a decade. So what's your response to that charge from the administration?
Most of the people, Salvadorans that are protected under TPS, have been here for almost 20 years in the United States. Both Republican and Democratic presidents and previous administrations have extended the program. There's definitely an argument to be said that a permanent solution needs to be found. And it's definitely up to Congress to really find that permanent solution. So we're working to work with Congress. We're fighting to make sure that we push for legislation that has permanent solutions for this population. But the TPS program has been very successful in protecting nationals that come from those nations that are devastated due to natural disaster, armed conflict, or any other circumstances that don't allow them to return. This program has been very successful. This is a community that is hardworking. Over 90% of people with TPS work. There's about 200,000 children of Tepecianos that are from El Salvador that are U.S. citizens that are also going to be affected. We have to find a permanent solution for this population that contributes and does so much for this country.
So we're talking about people that have been here since 2001, right? That's about 17 years. If they get deported, as you mentioned, they have about 200,000 U.S.-born children. Are those kids going to be stuck here without their parents because they're all American citizens, or are they going to be deported too?
They're U.S. citizens, so they cannot be deported.
Uh-huh.
However, but
they lose their parents, though, right?
Exactly. You're talking about separating families. And this country was based on those principles of family unification, of keeping families together. The family is the strongest unit in our communities. And so it is hypocritical for this administration to make a decision like this that has such devastating effects on hundreds of thousands of families of U.S.-born citizen children. These children will be without their parents, many who are minors. So there's a complete devastation in these communities and these families. These families are having to come up with emergency plans for their children. These are children that have never been to these countries. These are children that are subject to incredible danger in El Salvador, where there is a huge gang problem that is as a result of the U.S. war on drugs, the failed U.S. War on drugs that has greatly affected the stability of the region, of the Central American region.
But that's a whole other source of emigration to the United States, that where young children, where unaccompanied minors were coming up here in droves because their parents were sending them because their gangs were trying to recruit them. And they, you know, and you either had to join MS-13 or get killed. And these kids took this incredibly hazardous journey. So what's the fate of those kids under DACA?
So Unaccompanied children have come to the United States, and most of these kids are helped through the asylum process, right?
Right.
And not necessarily DACA, no. But yes, I mean, that is a crisis that we lived through in 2014, and that those number of children have unaccompanied children have continued to come, fleeing incredible violence in El Salvador. There are more homicides today in El Salvador than during the Civil War. So this is a real threat. This is a real problem for young people. And now we're talking about over 200,000 U.S. citizen children that have parents with TPS that are in danger of having to return to El Salvador, having never been there, and face these threats and this danger. They're prime for the gang violence, and so we're going to do everything in our power to prevent that and to make sure that we can protect as many families as possible. People should seek legal counsel to see if there's other immigration remedies available to them, but we're also going to continue to fight in Congress to push for legislation to find a permanent solution.
Well, can you find a permanent solution for El Salvador itself, though? Because that seems to be what we get back to in this conversation. If you've got a situation where you've got the worst gang problem in the world, there's more people being killed in El Salvador by gangs than there were during the Civil War, and then you've got all these kids leaving to their parents, sending them on this hazardous journey to save their lives. And DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that granted deportation relief and work permits to nearly 700,000 recipients. And Trump has already rescinded DACA. The long and the short of it is that if you're going to start deporting kids back to this situation where they're going to be in more danger, and then have to flee again, it doesn't make any sense. What would make sense is to figure out how you could make life in El Salvador livable for its own people. And is anybody talking about that or even planning to do anything about that? Or what's your understanding of where we stand on making El Salvador more livable for its people?
Absolutely. You are correct in that we really need to address the root causes, and we really need to address the situation in El Salvador to make sure that people feel safe in their country, that people feel that they can live and have opportunity, to have a good life and a safe life for themselves and their families in their country. A big factor in that discussion is U.S. foreign policy. If we continue to pour billions of dollars into border expansion, if we continue to pour billions of dollars into additional military aid, if we continue to pour billions of dollars in the war on drugs, this will continue to be a region that is devastated and unsafe. So really, foreign policy needs to change from that perspective in the criminalization of people from Central America. And the foreign policy needs to focus on rebuilding a nation that has been devastated by decades and decades of war and violence. It needs to be a foreign policy and investment in the nation that focuses on developing infrastructure in systems in this country. So we definitely have to talk about root causes and how we can create in El Salvador where people feel safe to live and to stay and not have to abandon their homes. You know, immigrants, Salvadoran immigrants, don't take this decision lightly. If they're leaving this country, it's because it's a life and death decision.
Well, ironically, didn't the MS-13 gang that Trump always makes statements about them, and he spoke to a bunch of police up in Suffolk County in New York, we made that famous or infamous statement urging the police to rough up their suspects and not to be so nice to them. But that whole meeting was about MS-13. Everything that Trump has done has actually helped MS-13. There was a MS-13 gang member on television a little while back, obviously in disguise, saying that Trump was the best thing happened to MS-13 because he's gone after the Latino community in the broadest and most racist sense with his anti-Latino rhetoric. And Latino communities are so nervous that they're not likely to cooperate with the police, and pointing out who are the members of MS-13. And by the way, MS-13, I believe, started here in Los Angeles as a street gang during the Civil War in El Salvador. And these were kids that were largely without parents and had seen awful violence down there. and brought that violence with them. So that seems to tie into your point that you just made about U.S. foreign policy being at the heart of this.
Well, I mean, this is a very complicated issue. It's a very complex issue. But we know that either here in the United States or in El Salvador, if you want to solve a gang problem, you really have to look at what the reasons are. You really have to look at that we have a failing educational system for our children, that we have this systemic criminalization of our communities of color, particularly young men of color. We have to realize that we don't have opportunities and programs to retain these kids and to provide them a good education and give them an alternative. So I think that us as a society need to also take responsibility to what is happening here in the United States and abroad, because the United States has a huge responsibility in a long time negative history with this region in terms of what they have done and what they have invested in creating war or prolonging war in those countries. So it is complicated. We know that the United States has a lot to do with it and a lot of responsibility, and definitely terminating a program like Temporary Protective Status, TPS, that has worked and that protects over 200,000 Salvadorans who contribute to their communities, who pay their taxes, who are critical workers in significant industries throughout the country, like the construction and service industries, is not the answer to solve these problems, both here and abroad.
Well, Martha Arevalo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Martha Arevalo, who is the executive director of the Central American Resource Center, CARACEN. She has held that position since 2012 and specializes in immigrant advocacy work, community outreach, and Latino strategic communications. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further Trump's anti-immigrant purge and go to Honduras to speak with a scholar who focuses on the experience of the forced migration of children and youth fleeing gang violence.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Time to send someone away. I've got my back covered. Said, how you been all that astray? Come, let's count. It's absurd. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Honduras is Elizabeth Kennedy, a scholar who focuses on the experiences and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She has worked as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States in El Salvador, and has assisted El Salvadorans fleeing gang violence. And she is currently in Honduras working on the study about child and families leaving Honduras. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Kennedy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as you know, I'm sure, Elizabeth, President Trump has just announced that about 200,000 Salvadorans who have been living in the United States for 17 years or more have been told that they need to get out of the country by September 2019 or face deportation. There have already been over 50,000 Haitians given similar notice and 2,500 Nicaraguans. And now apparently the Trump administration plans to eliminate this TPS, temporary protective status, for some 57,000 Hondurans. You're in Honduras. My understanding is in Honduras, along with El Salvador and Venezuela, are among the most violent countries in the world with the highest murder rates. What is likely to happen to these 50,000 Hondurans if they're forced back into Honduras?
Yes, so El Salvador and Honduras do have the two highest homicide rates In countries without a declared war, Venezuela also has a very high homicide rate that surpasses the two. Unfortunately, for temporary protected status, even though it recognizes that the status should be granted for emergencies and threats to public safety and health, the Trump administration has been unwilling to consider these high homicide rates as indicative of a situation that threatens public health and public safety, even though it very much does and is recognized to threaten public health and public safety by a number of international actors.
Well, there's also political chaos, is there? I mean, there's a lot of political chaos in Venezuela, but there's also in Honduras, there's a disputed election. And I spoke recently with the nephew of the famous environmentalist, Bertha Caceres, who was murdered by shadowy figures in Honduras. So what's the political status and stability of the country at the moment?
Well, I just arrived back to Honduras yesterday, so I'm not the most abreast of the situation here in this country, but it's my understanding that the announcement was about El Salvador today. Mm-hmm. And the situation there continues to be incredibly dangerous for those who are returning. It is documented in El Salvador that persons have been murdered after their deportation, that women have been raped after their deportation, and this violates international law and international principles of non-refoulement. So the idea that we will not return someone to harm, torture, or murder.
Well, El Salvador is a very small country of 6.2 million people, many below the poverty line. There's clearly a serious gang problem, and homicides may have gone down a little bit over the past 2 years, but there's still roughly 4,000 killings last year, which apparently is the highest murder rate in Central America, at more than 60 homicides per 100,000 people. And the year that this TPS was granted because of the earthquakes, that was 2001, and in that year there were 2,300 homicides. So what do you understand about similar figures in Honduras?
So in Honduras, the homicide rate has fallen consistently from year to year since 2013. That said, its homicide rate remains incredibly high. It is still in the top five among the world, including war zones. So El Salvador surpassed it in 2014. Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Venezuela are also above it. Sudan and Somalia switching out. You know, the thing when we look at homicide rates, if they're high, we have to ask the question of why. And what it tells us is about a state that is not protecting its citizens. You know, that can be related to issues of willingness. So then we get into issues of impunity, corruption, and it can also be related to capacity. These are countries with limited resources. They may not have their officials trained in the way that they would like, and they may not have, you know, like testing for DNA evidence in order to bring to trial and convict those who committed the killing. So when no one then goes to prison for the crime or is held accountable in a different way, it fuels the cycle of violence. And that exists in Honduras, that exists in El Salvador, it exists in Guatemala as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, a scholar who focuses on the experiences and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She has worked as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States in El Salvador, and has assisted Salvadorans fleeing gang violence, and is now in Honduras, where she's working on a study on children and families leaving the country. So I guess it gets back to a fundamental question, surely, Elizabeth, and that is, when you think about the 200,000 El Salvadorans who've just been told they've got to get out of the U.S., over 50,000 Haitians who were told recently they have to leave, 2,500 Nicaraguans, and the estimated 57,000 Hondurans that will soon be told to leave the United States. On top of that, President Trump rescinded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, and that gave a reprieve from deportation for nearly 700,000 current recipients. So it's pretty clear that there's going to be a wholesale purging, if you will, or deportation of Central Americans from the United States. But the fact that so many of them are here in the United States, particularly unaccompanied children, because their parents send them on this incredibly hazardous journey through Mexico to come to the United States, it just seems so cruel that we'd be sending these kids back to a very uncertain future, if not a certain death in some cases. Is there anything that can be done to make these countries more livable, like El Salvador and Honduras? Wouldn't that be the sensible priority here?
That's definitely the sensible priority. And I think one thing that most people in the United States don't fully grasp and understand is that most Salvadorans, Hondurans, and Guatemalans want to be able to live safely in their country. You know, these are physically beautiful countries. There are certain parts of the ways of life that are better than in the United States. But at the end of the day, when you hit a point that you cannot stay and survive because you receive a death threat, not only on yourself, but on those you love, you don't have a decision and you have to flee. So you ask a really good question. What can we do to address that? And to address that, we are looking at the actors who are making the threats. So whether that's corrupt state officials, whether that's gangs, whether that's cartels, we have to start thinking, how do we get rid of corruption? How do we get rid of organized crime? And it's not necessarily the same thing, because the corruption within the state is what facilitates the existence of organized crime. Sometimes officials, especially in the United States, like to focus on the organized crime piece. It plays well to an audience, but ultimately what facilitates its existence is corruption within the state. So if I were making recommendations, I would want to root out corruption among state institutions and put a lot of emphasis on improving the technology that's used in the criminal justice system and trying to actually take to trial, especially crimes of homicide and rape, that occur in each of these countries.
So, I mean, there's a sense here in the United States, and certainly amongst the immigrant communities from Central America and from Mexico. It's no secret. When Donald Trump announced his run for the presidency, he characterized Latinos and Mexicans as rapists and murderers, and qualified it a little by saying, "I'm sure there's some good people as well." Hardly a ringing endorsement. So, my understanding amongst at least this community and the Latinos in this country is that this is all about President Trump pandering to his hardcore anti-immigrant base. How do Hondurans see it?
I think for Hondurans, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, it has certainly generated a large amount of fear, anxiety, distrust. Because for the majority of those who made it to the United States, they did flee. They didn't migrate. You know, they had to leave. They lost everything, or they knew they were going to lose everything. And they made the most difficult decision of their lives to seek something better, not just for themselves, but for others, their families and their community. And so many of them had already experienced raids, had already experienced uncertainty, had already been treated as if they were the worst and didn't have value. And I think that's what hurts, particularly for me, a U.S. citizen, that that's now happening to these people, to Hondurans, to Guatemalans, to Salvadorans in the United States, a place that was supposed to be safe for them and was supposed to allow them to pursue their dreams. Because if anyone's ever met a Salvadoran, a Guatemalan, a Honduran, and gotten to know them well, they are among the hardest working people that you'll meet. Most of them are working two or three jobs. They want the best for their children and their entire community, so they're not just trying to get ahead for themselves. They are ideal citizens and people that anyone who gets them are lucky to have.
Well, it is. There's a certain element of cruelty here, obviously, and it is hard to comprehend. And it does seem to be about pandering to the more xenophobic, if not racist, elements in this country. But how much is there also a denial on the part of us here in the United States in general about how much this is a legacy or a consequence of our foreign policy? Because, for example, the MS-13 gang that is a part of the problem in El Salvador, since gang violence is so high there, that gang was formed here in Los Angeles during the El Salvadoran Civil War. And these were kids fleeing El Salvador, had seen horrible violence, and to some extent were already damaged goods. So to that extent, that's just a sort of window into a kind of a blowback, if you will, from U.S. foreign policy.
I definitely agree. I think in general, the majority of the U.S. population is unaware of U.S. foreign policy and is also unaware of, you know, even where El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are. I'm from a rural area of East Texas, and one thing that people like to say there when I explain my work is, why would we invest in people in a different country when we have people in need in our own country? And my response to them is always, first of all, it's not actually a choice. You don't have to choose to help one or the other. You can choose to help both at the same time. But U.S. foreign policy has very much shaped the entirety of the Americas, and often in very negative ways, particularly in the Northern Triangle of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. You know, not only are we looking at the exportation of gangs, because indeed both MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang began in Los Angeles, but we're also looking at the funding priorities that the U.S. government makes in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And the majority of aid that's received here in the region is military aid. And going back to this point of corruption, it's well documented that the police and the military are participating in abuses of their citizens, and sometimes further back anyway, in documented massacres. And so there needs to be an examination of the way that U.S. money is spent in the region, particularly when you know that the authorities are involved in corruption and often violent repression.
Well, this, of course, is the lingering suspicions about this recent election, is that the winner of the election, and he was behind, and then suddenly they stopped the counting mysteriously. The computer shut down, and suddenly he was ahead. And most election observers believe that the results are totally contaminated, if not completely rigged. And he is now still running the country, is he not? As far as I know, the U.S. is supporting him.
Yes. So a number of observers, including the Organization of the American States, which to my knowledge had not before made as strong of a statement as it did, found that the irregularities in the elections were persistent throughout the process and meant that the determination, the final declaration of the Electoral Tribunal could not be trusted. They called for a second round of elections to be held between the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, and the person who was winning, Nasrallah, before the system went down. And to date, the current administration has been unable or unwilling to accept that suggestion. And indeed, the United States has said that that's unnecessary, that it's not in the Constitution, even though nothing has actually gone according to the Honduran Constitution. Because if you go further back, re-election was actually prohibited until 2012, when the current president did, with his political party, petition to have the Constitution changed.
Well, just in the last minute, is it likely, though, Elizabeth, at the end of the day, that all of these people that are being deported from the United States or threatened with deportation, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, are they likely at the end of the day to be sent back to their home countries and then have to flee again to the United States?
It's incredibly likely that they will have to flee again, because the circumstances and conditions here have not changed. It would be different if the circumstances and conditions had, but particularly for the most impoverished, who are in these gang-controlled neighborhoods where there is not a state presence, they're going to go back to the same. And I want to emphasize again that in my own research, I have documented that people have been murdered. And I think too many people don't ever consider that that's what you're sending them back. They say send back, and you know, you are sending these people back to a potential death. And we like to focus a lot on how dangerous the journey is. So how could you send someone back knowing that they're going to have to flee again on that dangerous journey? It is infuriating, and it doesn't take into account all of the evidence and documentation that exist even within the U.S. Department of State human rights reports that they issue each year. They make clear that the situation is not livable for the majority of Hondurans, Guatemalans, and Salvadorans.
Well, Elizabeth Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I mean, speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, who's a scholar who focuses on the experience and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She worked as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States in El Salvador and has assisted Salvadorans fleeing gang violence. And Elizabeth is currently in Honduras working on the study of children and families leaving the country. And she joined us from Honduras. Thank you very much again, Elizabeth Kennedy.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the dismissal of charges against the Bundy family in Nevada, who have gotten away with pointing assault rifles at federal officials.
Politics need votes. Politics needs your mind. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lies.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot his..."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Hersick, who is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. His research primarily relates to Nevada state and local government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Hersick.
Thanks for having me.
And the mistrial today of the case against Clive and Bundy and his two sons, these ranchers just outside of Las Vegas, is pretty extraordinary, because we saw Clive and Bundy and his cohorts protest at a wildlife refuge up in Oregon, which resulted in the death of one of the heavily armed militia types that had flocked to the Bundy banner. And we know that this whole incident stemmed from a group of BLM, Bureau of Land Management, federal agents trying to protect a corral full of cattle that had been grazing on public land, which apparently Clive and Bundy had been doing for 20 years, not paying grazing fees to the government, and they're pretty minor and pretty nominal. Everybody else, apparently, all of his neighboring ranches paid. And then all the, I think about 400 of these militia types showed up on that occasion and outgunned the feds, who withdrew. So on the balance, it would seem, Eric, that how in God's name did the feds blow this case?
It is a little mind-boggling. Certainly, Bundy, your description is correct. Bundy hasn't paid his grazing fees, as I think every other rancher in Nevada does, hasn't for years, claims the federal government does not have authority over the land, has made these kind of half-hearted, "Oh, I'll pay the county because I respect the county." It's almost posse comitatus belief that the sheriff is the, you know, legal source. But essentially, he's been freeloading on public land. Then when the BLM did move to seize his cattle, word went out, and militia types, as you note, came and basically, through a force of, or a show of arms, forced the federal government to back down. It got worse. They went up and seized government property in Oregon, where in that trial, you only got a handful of, most of it was dismissed. You got a couple of guilty pleas. The federal government just has not figured out how to prosecute this case.
So what's the problem? I mean, the judge in this case was, I believe, a protege of Harry Reid. She's a Latina. I think her politics are pretty liberal. She's certainly not in any way ideologically sympathetic, I think, to these anti-government militia types. So she gave one of the most, I think, scorching attacks on the federal prosecutors that most people have seen in federal court.
Well, the federal prosecutors, I think, made two major errors, and this goes back also to the Oregon case. They overreached in terms of the charge. They really wanted to stick this as some sort of grand conspiracy. And it was far more of a grassroots kind of gathering of these armed so-called patriots. Now, you can say, well, see, then that's not an overreach. Wait a minute. You can't show up and point your weapons at government officials doing their job. And yet they didn't go after that particular charge. There were numerous weapons charges they could have gone after these folks, particularly Bundy's sons, a couple of whom have convictions and would have been illegally maintaining or holding weapons. They didn't go for those charges. They went for much higher level charges and much harder to prove the conspiracy charges. And that's what was dismissed in Oregon, and that's what was going to be problematic here in Nevada. The second thing they did, which drew the ire of the judge, was that the federal prosecutors withheld evidence. There was plenty of evidence of botched investigations, of not sharing what had been done by one particular agent who, I don't know if he absolutely lied about some things going on, but certainly that was evidence that should have been shared with the defense. It wasn't. And if you want to get on the wrong side of a judge in any trial, whether you're prosecutor or defense, if you are withholding evidence, that's a sure way to do it.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Hersick, who is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, American presidency, and the politics of Nevada. His research primarily relates to Nevada state and local government. So apparently what was at issue, though, with discovery, that they didn't share this with the defense, was some surveillance video that was taken supposedly by FBI agents that may not have been identified at the time. Is that your understanding?
That's part of it. That's what I understand is part of this, that the feds needed to just come clean with everything they had. However, again, their reach for conspiracy charges, that was always going to be the harder claim to prove. I mean, that has to show cohesion and intent, and I don't know why they withheld this. And then as the newspaper started to get wind of it and started to particularly expose one agent in particular who was disciplined for various items, you could see this case unraveling in a hurry based on the charges that they were making.
Well, but if you or I pointed a loaded assault rifle at a federal official, I think it's an AFO, isn't it? An assault on a federal official? Isn't that commonly used federal charge?
I agree. They could have gotten weapons charge.
By the way, you'd probably get shot if you did that.
Yeah,
you
know? Absolutely. I've told my classes that if I said I don't recognize the authority of the federal government. Let's say I was at a marijuana shop and the feds come in with Jeff Sessions and say, you know, we're going to, you know, arrest you all. And everybody in the marijuana shop says, oh, no, we don't recognize federal authority here. And we all pulled out our weapons. I don't think we would be treated as fairly or as gently as Mr. Bundy was. One of the great ironies here is that Bundy and his so-called patriot cohorts will say, oh, the system's rigged, we can't get a fair trial. In fact, they were able to take advantage of every legal protection you have under American jurisprudence and now are walking away.
Well, they're walking away as heroes, I assume, in the militia movement amongst the so-called patriots. And as far as I can tell, nobody's pointing out the obvious irony, if not hypocrisy, of the idea that you're these anti-government, get-the-government-off-my-back types, and yet you're freeloading and mooching off the taxpayer. I mean,
well, I'll agree with you and point it out. I mean, the fact that you're on federal land. Well, no, that's not federal land. Well, it's not your land either. And they say, well, we live next to it, so that gives us some sort of ownership rights. Absolutely not. This land is held by American citizens. I know I could make a claim. If I went out there and said, I'm going to ride my motorcycles and graze my cattle out there, I'm sure the Bundys would complain and say, oh, no, you're on our property. Absolutely not. This was federal land. It's recognized as federal land. It's constitutionally protected as federal land, and the feds can own this property. And Bundy's gotten away with this for years. He's no hero among most ranchers in Nevada who are paying these fees, even though they may not like the fees. But I think you're right that among this kind of group of so-called patriots, these uber anti-government folks, he is now a hero.
But this land is now a national monument. It's the Gold Butte National Monument. So there are all kinds of protections for national monuments. As you say, you couldn't go in there and with an off-road vehicle or start shooting at things. I mean,
no. Well, it's a total double standard. They're getting away with it. And then when they go to court, essentially are given every legal protection, as they should, from the very government that they claim is out to get them, that will not treat them fairly. And the hypocrisy is astounding, but I'm sure that they won't see it that way. And among the patriots, they'll say, see, we have struck a blow for liberty.
So what's the next step? Because I believe the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is already looking into this, isn't he? From the earlier mistrial on December the 20th, when Judge Navarro declared a mistrial.
Well, I think the next step is there is going to be a thorough review of the federal attorney's office here in the state of Nevada. I don't know in terms of substance what they're going to do. I would doubt they're going to refile charges. They've now lost a fairly embarrassing case in Oregon. This one gets dismissed. And you've got evidence that during discovery things were not released. I think it's a pretty poisoned pool in terms of trying to go forward with this. So the federal government is walking away with the proverbial egg on their face. Jeff Sessions is certainly no kind of crusader against these so-called patriots. And so I have a feeling the federal government is going to go after their own in terms of the attorney's office in Nevada, and that the Bundys are going to ride off in the sunset, at least for the near to medium term.
So this is not a case, and I'm just making an assumption, that there may be within federal law enforcement a kind of understanding not to provoke these heavily armed militia types, because their whole mythology is based on Waco and Ruby Ridge and all of these incidents that where they believe the federal government has overstepped, and they essentially see themselves as martyrs. I mean, could that be at play? Because it seems to me this is more a case of the AUSAs, the U.S. attorneys in Nevada, being overzealous and incompetent, as opposed to some kind of tacit understanding amongst federal prosecutors to treat these nutcases with kid gloves.
Well, I agree that the federal prosecutors are, I don't know what they're going to do now, the ones in Nevada. In terms of law enforcement's perspective on this, yes, there is this both mythology on among the patriots that the government shot down these innocent folks at Waco and Ruby Ridge. LaFoy Finnegan, who was the individual from Oregon who was shot now by FBI agents, and he, you know, brandishing a gun, although the legend now is, no, he was unarmed. They planted the gun. You are now into such conspiracy theory types that I think the federal law enforcement is a little leery to, in a sense, go after these folks, because they would have to use, most likely, pretty overwhelming force. And that's bad public relations. And for whatever reason, the Bundys, you know, Clive and Bundy on horseback waving a flag gets to do things that if you and I did them, particularly in an urban setting, pointing guns at law enforcement or government agents, I wouldn't say we would fare very well in terms of our lives. But Bundy, right now, is getting away with it.
But just back to this video that was taken surreptitiously within the Bundy Ranch during the standoff, I'm assuming that that was not at the corral where the BLM guys that were armed were driven off by the 400-plus heavily armed militia types. What do we know about this video that was taken during the standoff? And apparently it provided evidence that FBI agents were involved in the incident. Previously, I guess everybody assumed it was just the BLM people. So the fact that we're told that the video was taken within the ranch, the Bundy Ranch, that would indicate to me that it wasn't taken at the scene of the standoff.
But that's part of the problem of the case now, is that this evidence really wasn't fully vetted. You were all speculating about, you know, what was the role of the FBI, what was the role of the so-called Patriots, and that needed to be addressed upfront, transparent, and then there wouldn't be now this almost alternative history of what went on at the Bundy Ranch and who did what and when they did it.
Well, this was, of course, 2014, this standoff took place, and the Bundy Ranch is in this Bunkerville. That's a rather appropriate the name of a town for a guy with I'm sure he's got a bunker full of guns, this guy Bundy. And my sense is that these guys are just going to be even more emboldened now. They've won twice. You know, this is extraordinary. As I say, any other citizen pointing assault rifles at federal officers would be either shot immediately or would be thrown in jail. So this is what I can't get my head around. There's a weird double standard here with these super right-wing militia guys. You know, I mean, if you're some young black activist in St. Louis protesting, you don't get treated like the Bundys do.
I would completely agree with you. It's a double standard. It's partially kind of locational, that out on the range, the Bundys and these so-called Patriots actually do kind of outnumber and outgun law enforcement. And in an urban area, you would never get away with this. I mean, it would be, and if I'm an African-American looking at this saying, wait a minute, our people, our kids are being shot, they're unarmed, and yet the Bundys can point a gun at law enforcement seemingly with impunity. Will they be emboldened? I think so. They'll still have this culture of, oh, we were mistreated. And I don't know how they're going to reconcile all their claims about the system is so rigged against them when they get a decision like this.
Well, Eric Herzig, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Herzig, who's a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches American politics, American presidency, and politics of Nevada. His research primarily relates to Nevada state and local government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.